Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we will continue with the with a discussion of the Hemavata Sutta. This is from the Sutta Nipata. And I continue from where I left off last time. But first I just give a little summary of where we've come so far. Okay, this sutta unfolds as a dialogue between, or it begins as a dialogue between two beings who are called yakas or yakshas. As I explained earlier, the yakshas are, we call them demonic type of beings or spirits who have within them, we can call it a divine nature. They have the potential for enlightenment, the potential for realization, but on the surface they sometimes appear to be frightening or demonic beings. And these two yakshas in earlier lives had been devotees of a Buddha, and so they had strong connections with the Buddha's teaching. And now they had taken rebirth during the time of Gautama Buddha's teaching. They had taken rebirth in the form of yakshas. One of them had taken rebirth in the Himalaya regions, and he was named Hemavata. The other had taken rebirth in the middle region of India, in the Ganges plain area, and his name was Satagira. On one occasion, they met in the Himalaya mountains, and Satagira told his friend Hemavata that the Buddha Gautama had appeared in the world, and he urged Hemavata to come to see the Buddha. Hemavata asked him questions about the Buddha, and in reply, Satagira praised the moral qualities of the Buddha. First, the moral qualities. Then he praised the Buddha as one who is possessed of superior knowledge and higher conduct. Then as one who had destroyed all the defilements or corruptions of the mind and had attained liberation, release, or the experience of nirvana. So then Hemavata decided to go with his friend to see the Buddha, to ask him questions about how one achieves liberation from the bondage of birth and death. Together they went to see the Buddha. Hemavata asked him very deep, very penetrating questions. And the Buddha replied to him, responding to him, telling him about how the world originates through the experience in the six sense bases, and how it's through our attachment and aversion to the objects that we encounter through the six sense bases that we repeatedly become entangled in suffering. And then the Buddha continued that it is by detaching ourselves from our craving through the six senses that we are released or liberated from suffering. That was the explanation that took us up through verse number 19 of the sutta, or 171 in the Sutta Nipata. Okay, now when the Buddha completed that explanation, something remarkable took place according to the commentary to the sutta. When the two yakshas, these two demons, and according to the text, to the commentary, these two demons, and this will be supported by the sutta itself, these two demons were each the leaders of entourages of 500 demons each. So altogether, there were 1,000 demons who went to see the Buddha. The ones who were at the head asking the questions were just the two leaders, Hemavata and Satagira. But altogether, there were 1,000 demons in the presence of the Buddha asking these questions. And as I explained in my first talk, if you have skeptical ideas about these demons, one doesn't have to take the dramatic setting of the sutta literally. One could see this as an imaginative creation by the authors of the sutta, whereby they are attempting to cast deep spiritual truths that would have actually arisen through dialogues with the Buddha, attempting to cast them in a dramatic setting that would attract the interest, arouse the interest of simple village people to whom monks might be preaching in their preaching rounds. That is one way to understand this dramatic setting for those who are skeptical about the traditional explanation. But I don't think we should write the traditional explanation off out of hand, since there might be there might truly exist such demonic beings that we just have not encountered ourselves. So, continuing, when the Buddha had concluded his explanation to this group of 1,000 demons, the 1,000 demons expressed their appreciation to the Buddha, and as they were reflecting upon the Buddha's explanation, there arose in all of them the stainless, dust-free eye of the Dhamma. What is this stainless, dust-free eye of the Dhamma? This is the vision of truth, the vision of the ultimate nature of things, the eye of wisdom that pierces into the truth of impermanence, suffering, selflessness, and then pierces right through the selfless nature of things to see into the unconditioned reality, nirvana. And with this arising of the vision of truth, the eye of truth, the vision of the Dhamma, all of those demons became sotapannas, stream enterers. They all were transformed into noble disciples of the Buddha. They had now become what we would call saints, saintly beings. You could say that they had cast off their demonic nature, and the divine nature that was latent within them came to fully flowered, and they became transformed into divine beings. Okay, but they had still not yet satisfied their thirst to understand the Dhamma. They still wanted to learn more. And so now the leader of the group, Hemavata, who was extremely intelligent, had a very penetrating intellect, wanted to ask the Buddha some further questions. And that takes us to verse 173. Again, I will recite, as usual, I will recite the verse in Pali, and then I will give the explanation. Give the translation, then the explanation. Kosudatarati yogam kodatarati anavam apatite yanalambe kogambire nasitati. Okay, his question is in the form of a metaphor. He says, okay, we could follow the book translation. Who is the one, the text has the word here, who is the one here who crosses the flood? Who is the one here who crosses the sea without a footing and when not supported, who will not sink in the deep ocean and sea? This is a very, very deep question. And it has subtle doctrinal implications. That's why this seems to suggest that the question had been asked by somebody, but the words of the question had been asked, the wording of the question had been framed by somebody who actually understood the technicalities of the doctrine. Okay, so who here crosses the flood? And here when the word flood is used, it refers to something that was an important part of life in everyday India. Because in India, especially during the rainy season, heavy rains would fall daily, one day after the next, until the rivers would build up. These large rivers would build up until they would overflow, and there would be huge floods. And people, sometimes when the rivers would overflow, then that flooding rivers would sweep away their homes, flood over their lands, flood over their fields. And so this was a big problem of everyday life in India. And so it became the image of a kind of calamity, a disaster that people were constantly fearful of. And so in Buddhism, this word flood came to symbolize certain, call them disasters or catastrophes within the human mind that one has to cross over to attain liberation. And within the technical Buddhist terminology, the word flood came to signify four particular defilements. These are the floods of sensual desire, the craving for sense pleasures. Then the flood of craving for individual existence in samsara. Then the flood of holding to wrong views. And fourth, the flood of ignorance. Okay, then the second part of the question, who here crosses the sea? Here this word in Pali, anava, suggests something which is a body of water which is very vast and very deep. And this is taken to be a metaphor for the sea of samsara. That is, samsara is the sea or ocean of birth and death, by which we go from one life to the next, from birth to old age and death, then from death to new birth, and then to new old age and death. Okay, now the next two lines are quite interesting. Without a footing, or without any foundation, without anything to stand upon below, an alambe, without anything to hang on to above, without any support above, who does not sink in the deep ocean? And why I say these lines are interesting, because three of these words here in Pali, apatite analambe gambire, these three words, without any foothold, without any support above and deep, are also used to describe nibbana, nirvana. So they're used to describe both nibbana and samsara. And yet, in relation to both, they have different senses. There's a famous sutta, it comes in the Udana, in which the Buddha says that there is a base or a state in which there is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor air, neither this world nor any other world. That is without any footing, without any support, without any becoming. That, the Buddha says, is the end of suffering. That is nirvana. But here the Buddha is speaking about the state that is the real danger, this real catastrophe of samsara. That too is without any footing, because there is no safety, no security in samsara. Just any day some catastrophe can happen. One place or another. Just yesterday, earthquake in Pakistan, 1,000 people killed. Last month, 6 weeks ago, in New Orleans. There, of course, there were predictions, even a year ago, there could be a catastrophe there. Nobody takes any action, but it happens. So many people swept away from their homes, so many people killed, so many lose all of their property, their life savings. Any place on earth, things can happen. Last year, almost just 1 year ago, tsunami hits South and Southeast Asia. So many thousands of people, 200,000, 300,000 people killed. So, there's really nothing to stand upon. No real secure foundation. You have life insurance, but it doesn't insure your life. Health insurance, it doesn't insure your health. Property insurance, it doesn't insure your property. in a way, those are just euphemisms, those names. There's no insurance against old age, sickness, death, property. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to give an answer to these questions. And the Buddha's answer is going to divide the questions in an interesting way and point to its subtle distinction, which seems to be implied by the questions themselves. This is the distinction. There are two important stages in the way to liberation. These are the stages of what we call the disciple in training. This is the disciple on the path. Technically, it's called the seka, the disciple in training. And the second stage is called the aseka, which means the one who is not in training, not because he's lazy and negligent, but the one who's not in training because he has completed the training. We might translate the aseka as the one beyond training, the one who has finished the training. The disciple in training is one who has reached the first stage of enlightenment, who has now acquired the path, entered the path, has entered the stream, that's the stream enterer, or the once returner, or the non-returner, but still has to practice more to reach the end of the path. And then the one beyond training, the one who has completed the training, that is the arahant. Now the Buddha's answers come in the two verses, verses 22 and 23. Verse 22 describes the disciple in training, the one on the path. And the Buddha's answer in verse 22 answers the first two questions of Hemavata, about who crosses the flood, who crosses the sea. So it seems those two questions are asking about the disciple in training. Then verse 23 describes the arahant, the one who has completed the training. And that verse answers the last question of Hemavata. That is the question about who does not sink in the deep ocean and sea. Okay, so let us take the Buddha's answers in turn. Okay, in verse 22, the Buddha says, one who is always virtuous, wise, well concentrated, who reflects or examines internally, and who is mindful, that one crosses the flood, which is so difficult to cross. Okay, so the Buddha's answers show the practices that have to be developed by a disciple in training. They show the constituents of the path that we have to develop in order to fulfill the training. Very concisely, they show this, which is quite remarkable, the way the Buddha can express just in a few feet of verse so many factors of training. So what are these factors of training? First is to be complete in virtue or moral discipline. That is, to undertake these basic principles of moral training, of ethical training. Particularly what's most essential to observe, the 10 courses of wholesome conduct. Not to kill, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct, speak the truth, not to slander others, not to speak harshly, not to engage in gossip or idle chatter, and to restrain one's mind from obsessive, greedy thoughts, ill will, and angry thoughts, and to have the basic right view of karma and its fruit. Then we have to take the sequence a little differently. Sometimes the sequence is changed a little to fit the meter from virtuous, because virtue is the basis, virtue is the foundation. Then we go to well concentrated and mindful. Mindfulness and well concentrated, being well concentrated, those two constitute the training in the higher mind, the higher consciousness. And so one takes mindfulness as the means of developing the mind. And by practicing mindfulness, awareness, consistently applying mindfulness to the development of a meditation subject, one brings the mind under control so that the mind doesn't just wander and stray recklessly, but the mind quiets down, becomes focused, well-disciplined, well-concentrated, until it's able to focus consistently on its object. Then the mind enters into these states of deep concentration and becomes su-samahito, well-concentrated. That is the development of the higher mind. Okay, then two other factors mentioned in the verse show the training in the higher wisdom. Ajatta chinti, that is, reflecting within himself or reflecting within herself. Let's just say reflecting or examining internally. That, we can say, is the means. One, when the mind becomes well concentrated, then one takes that concentrated mind and uses it as an instrument for examining what is the nature of my own experience. What is the nature of this body, this physical body consisting of form, physical form? And one examines the bodily form from the top of the head down to the tips of the feet, the tips of the toes, seeing how this body is made up of material elements always arising and ceasing, always changing. Then one takes this concentrated mind and focuses it upon the nature of the mind itself. And one sees how the mind is always changing. always arising and ceasing. The mind is coming into being, passing away, and everything connected with the mind is arising and passing away. So the body, the material elements of the body, arising and passing. The mind and all the mental factors arising and passing. So everything is impermanent. Everything is unstable. Everything is without any core, any solid substance, any inner self. So this is the development of panya, wisdom. And as that wisdom deepens and sharpens, it starts to cut off the fetters, the bonds, the defilements that keep one tied within this round of rebirths, this round of suffering, until one is able to cross over completely this flood, this ocean, which is deuterang, so difficult to cross. Okay, so this is verse number 174 on the disciple in training, and by implication, on the factors of training, the process of training, the practice itself. Okay, now in verse 175, or verse 23 of the sutta, the Buddha now is going to show, to explain the one who has completed the training, the disciple who has crossed over the flood, the ocean of birth and death, who stands on the dry land of nirvana and doesn't sink in the deep ocean anymore. So he says, again I will recite the Pali. Virato kama sanyaya sabba sangyo janatiko nandi bhava parikino so gambire nasidati. Taking the translation from the book. Actually, I don't quite like the first word here. Abstaining from lustful thoughts. It's one who has abstained. It's a past participle. One who has abstained from the perception of sensual pleasures and has gone beyond all fetters. One for whom delight in existence has been exhausted. He does not sink into the deep. Okay, that's a more literal translation of the verse. Okay, already at the third of the four stages of enlightenment, that is the stage of non-returner, one breaks the fetter of sensual desire, and so one no longer has any perception of sensual pleasures, no longer has any idea that there is any enjoyment to be obtained from the pleasures of the senses, because one now has a much greater happiness or joy. But it's only at the fourth stage, the stage of arhatship, that it's said that one has gone beyond all of the fetters. What are these 10 fetters that one has gone beyond? First, at the stage of stream enterer, the first stage of enlightenment, one breaks the fetter of wrong view of self, the wrong view of a permanent individual self. One breaks the fetter of doubt in the truth of the Buddha's teaching, doubt in the Buddha as a fully enlightened teacher, and one breaks the fetter of the belief in that observing certain rules and observances and rituals will take one to liberation. At the second stage of enlightenment, one doesn't break any fetters, though one weakens all the other fetters a little bit more. At the third stage, one breaks the fetter of sensual craving and anger and ill will. At the third stage, one breaks the craving for existence in the various higher realms of existence, the higher realms with form, and the craving for the higher realms of formless existence. One breaks the fetter of conceit. One breaks the fetter of restlessness or agitation. And finally, one breaks the fetter of ignorance. So at that point, one has gone beyond all of these fetters. Okay, and such a one, the Buddha says, has exhausted the delight in individual or conditioned existence. He's reached the ultimate, the unconditioned, and so there's no more delighting in any kind of finite individual existence. And this one no longer sinks in this deep ocean, this beginningless ocean of birth, aging, sickness, and death. Okay, when the Buddha gave that answer to the Yaksha Hemavata, Hemavata was so pleased that he recited two very beautiful verses of praise to the Buddha. I like these very, very much, and I like to recite them in Pali. It's a different meter from the other verses, and a change of meter, it's interesting, in the original.
Gambirapanyang nipunatadasing akinchanang kama bhaveyasattang Tang pasata saba divi pamutang dibe pate kama manang mahesing.
Okay, so according to the translation here, look at that great sage who possesses deep wisdom, very nice, gambira panyang, deep wisdom, let me translate my own way, who sees the subtle meaning, akinchanang, very powerful word. Literally, it's the man of nothing. You know, sometimes my mother used to say, "You're a nothing." as though it were a kind of put down. But here it's like a word of praise. The one who has no more attachments anymore. Just utter, it's like a statement of utter freedom to be just without anything anymore. Kama bhave asattam, who is not attached to sense pleasures or individual existence. See him who is utterly freed everywhere. The great sage who is walking the divine path. Then the next verse. Ano mana mang ni puna tadasing panya dadang kamalaye asatang tang pa sata sabavidung sumedang Arye pate kama manang mahesing. Look at that great sage of perfect name who sees the subtle meaning, who imparts wisdom, who is not attached to worldly pleasures or sensual pleasures. Behold him who is all-knowing, sabavidung, very powerful expression, sumedang, of bright knowledge. See the great sage walking the noble path. Okay, and then now Hemavata, speaking on behalf of all of the spirits, he's going to make a pledge. He says, I just will read in the English translation. We don't need the Pali for this. He says, a good sight indeed has arisen today. We have had a good daybreak, a beautiful arising, for we have seen the perfectly enlightened one who has crossed the flood, who is free from all of the asavas, from all of the taints or the influxes, the flowing passions. And here's where he refers to the thousand spirits or the thousand demons. He says, these thousand spirits assembled here who are possess great power and great glory or fame, all of these go for refuge to you. You are the Satta Anuttaro. You are the unsurpassed teacher, the noble teacher. We will wander from village to village, from mountain to mountain, paying our respects to the enlightened one and to his Dhamma. Actually, it says to his orderly or well-constructed teaching, well-composed, well-formulated teaching. And that is the end of the Hemavata Sutta. Okay, I thank you all for your attention, and I wish the blessings of the Triple Gem will be with you all. And we end just by sharing the merits with the devas, the buddhas, and all of the other beings, wishing them to protect this world and to protect the Buddha's teaching. Akasa ta cha bhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta cha bhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta cha bhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.